Welcome to the Virginia is for Laughers podcast, brought to you by the Funny Womax and Friends. If you're looking to get more out of your Shenandoah Valley experience, then this is the podcast for you. You'll meet interesting people, musicians, and comedians that perform here and find out more about what you can do and see. Whether you live here or plan to visit, listen to explore what makes our unique slice of heaven. Now here's your host, Don Davis Womack.
Hello, laughers. We are continuing our exciting series on health and fitness, and we have a special guest with us here today, Dr. Jeremy Akers. He is a professor of dietetics, a registered dietitian, and the graduate program director here at James Madison University. With a PhD in nutrition and a career focused on improving health through nutrition and exercise, Dr. Akers is here to share his incredible journey and give you some practical advice for how to have better nutrition and good weight management. Welcome to the show, Dr. Akers. It's great to have you on.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Thank you. Thank you for the time.
It is really exciting. We have a wealth of knowledge here at James Madison University.
Yes, we do. A lot of great faculty members here that I get to collaborate with every day. So it may be look a lot better. So that's why I like collaborating with them. So
yeah, there's a lot of smart people here for sure. I wanted to get into a little bit of your background, and I wanted to ask you, what inspired you to follow this career?
Yeah, so a little bit about my background. You know, I was at this, again, came from a really small town in Southwest Virginia. And, you know, kind of like a lot of people, majority of the time, you either, you know, went to a factory, you worked on a farm. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, my mom was pretty adamant that she wanted me to go to community college. So we had a little bit of money. And so she let me go to community college. I was like, okay, I'll go. I'll do something. So 13th grade, here I come.
13th grade.
You know, I enjoyed it. I was able to, you know, she helped me out with a semester and multiple semesters, and I was able to go through it. But then it was kind of one of those transitions of like, okay, what do you do now? You know, taking 3 years to get a 2-year degree, I need to do something. So I headed off to Radford and started off in computer science. I realized that I can't sit behind a computer desk the rest of my life.
Right.
There was one time I almost threw a computer across the room because the coding wouldn't do what I wanted to do. And I was like, I need to do something a little different.
I would call that a red flag.
It was a red flag. Okay. Big red flag. I talked to my mom, and I talked to, you know, the individuals on campus that helped kind of figure it out, taking the test and those types of things. And my mom, you know, something that's really stuck to me was like, okay, what are you interested in? What do you like doing? At that time, I got really big into, you know, lifting and, you know, watching what I was eating healthy, those types of things. And I kind of went through athletic training or nutrition. Those are the two degrees at Radford that I kind of met up with everything. And I was like, well, you know, I'm not the best looking guy ever. And going into the major that's like 98% female would give me a really good chance of actually finding a girlfriend. So I was like, okay, let's go nutrition. But
it's an interesting strategy.
I guess it worked. I married a dietitian, so I guess it worked. All kidding aside, that was a really good move for me. I really enjoyed it. It really helped out, you know, with my competing and those types of things. And I really got to learn a lot of cool things and meet a lot of people. From there, I really got interested in the sports aspect. Mm. That was just really interesting of how you can kind of, you know, with nutrition, how you can manipulate what you're consuming for, you know, performance, no matter what performance you're going into. And then JMU, they had a program that led to the registered dietitian credential, but it was focused in nutrition and physical activity. So I got to learn a little bit more about sports. Enjoyed that. You know, we had a speaker that was friends with the dietitian for the Washington Redskins at the time.
Oh, really?
I heard she made $300 an hour. I was like, oh gosh, that's what I'm going to do. And at that time,
my ears would perk up
yeah,
too.
Yeah, definitely $300 an hour. And you know, those jobs at that time, sports nutrition wasn't a huge field. It's kind of amazing. Just in the early 2000s, that wasn't a major field. And so it was really hard to get a job. Still had that passion. Again, some of the individuals that I worked with here at JMU were really influential. They're still mentors to me. And, you know, they were like, oh, you just go get a PhD. You know, you can kind of fine tune everything. At that time, point of life, I needed to work. So I worked for the Department of Health through WIC, Women's Infant Children.
I'm familiar, yeah.
And my role was actually interesting. They were kind of changing the department to, it wasn't only WIC, but it was Community Nutrition Services. Mm-hmm. And I got to come in and be the state obesity dietitian. And at that point, you know, my interest in just nutrition really changed, and just the obesity epidemic, and just how, you know, it's not going away. And it really struck my interest, and I was able to write grants and help people manage grants. And at that time, it was like, okay, yeah, I need to further to be able to help more individuals. I need to further my career. And then went to Tech and got my PhD, and now I'm here.
Now you're here.
Focusing mostly on chronic disease and obesity. So,
yeah. I'm glad you're here. That's exciting. Yeah. Do you do any more powerlifting at all?
No, my goals in the gym is go in and not hurt myself. That's my goals now.
That's actually my goal right now too. It's,
But yeah, no, I've had a few surgeries, and that kind of career kind of took a turn. But yeah, you know, it's just to work out, to try to get in every day, and the goals are a lot different. And so we always talk to students about, okay, what's your goals, and you know, what influences you, and you know, if you're talking to clients or talking to, you know, participants, what influences them is totally different than what influences like our little bubble here. So yeah, I still like working out, and I like doing it, just a little bit different, you know. Trying not to hurt myself. That's the main goal.
Start inching toward 40.
Well, I'm inching toward 50.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, okay.
Thank you. I didn't realize it looked that great.
Look at that. I'm 40, come with compliments today.
Yeah, thank you, Dawn.
You're welcome. Is that
I need to click like on the YouTube now.
Yes, for that comment.
Yeah, I click like. So.
Yeah. Where are we right now? Now that we take the podcast to the guests, I think it's great to share with them where we are. And this visual doesn't really give them an idea of where we are. So can you talk about that a little bit?
Where I am now. So I have been at JMU for...
In this room.
Where we are now.
Well, yeah.
Okay, you're transitioning.
I did total transition.
It's okay. So right now, we are in the Health and Behavioral Studies building here at JMU. Currently, we are in our dining room. So our nutrition program here, we have an undergrad, and we also have a graduate program as well, which we are training dietitians. That's what our goal here to do for both undergrad and grad. And so this dining room was it's on the first floor. It has lots of windows, lots of light.
Yeah.
But it's also kind of a scenic place where you see a lot of students come. We have meetings in here. We also have events. Last week, we had an event for everybody from CHBS to come in the dean's office. I, you know, made treats and had cider and hot chocolate and stuff. So it was really nice. So it's kind of a gathering place for a lot of people. We teach out of this room. We also have some of our labs out of this room as well. And then right behind us, behind this this nice mosaic here that Jamie really loves, we have an industrial-sized kitchen that we teach food service management. We also, our campus kitchen uses it as well. And when we right beside us, we have an experimental foods lab where we teach food science and teach product development. Those are some of the things we teach out of here. So not my expertise, but I do use these for different events and different things that we do on campus. So it gets used a lot.
Sounds like it. Yeah. The students that graduate in dietetics, what kinds of fields, where would they go work after they leave here?
Sorry.
Yeah, that's okay.
So it varies. You know, I think the field of nutrition is, again, one of the reasons why I was interested in it. There's a lot of things you can do with it. There's a lot of things that you have to know to be, you know, like one is, we don't really think about the food service management aspect of it. So looking at the microbiology of it, the safety, the sanitation of it, how to take one recipe and upscale it to 100, 150. Those are things we teach. One, we do have dietitians that go in food service management. That's probably not the most popular one. Pays the best, but not the most popular one. We have a lot of students that go into clinical, so working in a hospital setting, whether it's acute care, whether it's outpatients. We have seen this massive transition because of the job market of sports nutrition. I would say out of our grad students now, we probably have about six that they're really wanting to go into the sports nutrition world. And we're seeing a lot more jobs. It's kind of amazing that we're just now piecing it together that, you know, to be an elite athlete, you really have to kind of think about your nutrition. If you want to go to that next level, you really need to think about everything, not just the training, but also the nutrition as well. So we're seeing students going there. You know, we have former graduates that, that do sports nutrition. We have students, again, another big thing, especially with podcasts and influencers and those types of things, is really going into entrepreneurship. So being coaches, being nutrition coaches, wellness coaches. We have students that are doing that and doing really well. We have students that are doing it really well, but they have to have that. They have to have that personality, right?
Yeah.
They have to have that radio personality.
That's right.
They have to, but they also have to be very good with technology and have to, yeah. Have to really sell themselves.
Learn it.
Like, you know, it's hard when, you know, at our age to learn this kind of thing, but for them, it's really easy. But we're seeing, that's why some of our classes, we do look at product development and do some marketing, and even some of our classes, we teach them how to do podcasts. I don't, but some of our classes.
On nutrition.
Yeah, on nutrition. Yeah, so they do podcasts.
I had no idea. I'm glad I asked.
Yeah, so again, a lot of different things, you know, product development, you know, they're dietitians all over the place, not just the hospital. I mean, we, you know, Coke, Pepsi, you know, Swanson, all of them have dietitians as well. So, yeah.
That makes sense.
Kroger, Food Lion, Martin's.
Any food chain type of business. Yeah.
So a lot of different avenues to go. If you're interested in nutrition, you know, you can give a contact into this, and I got to do my little sales pitch. If you're interested in it, you can contact me, and I can teach you how to be a dietitian. So
I love it. And you have studied a lot of different avenues with regards to dietetics and weight management. I'm wondering, out of the research you've done, what are some of the more memorable projects that you feel have helped shape your approach to what you do?
Yeah, so I'll give you one. I will give you a few examples if you want them.
Yes,
so
I do.
So one of them, this was a big eye opening for me, and this is an undergrad. This was at Radford, and our cohort was really small, but our professor, she was awesome, and she allowed. We had most dietetics, they have the senior, almost like a, you know, senior capstone type of class that you know, what do you do next, right? We as a class, I think our class was, you know, 14, 15. We decided we wanted to kind of run a weight management clinic. And that was one of the things that we wanted to do. At the time, I thought I was, you know, I was a weightlifter.
Yep.
I thought everybody should do exactly what I was doing. Everybody should be in everybody has the capability of being in the gym for 3 hours a day and weighing all their food and, you know, cutting the fat off their chicken. Cause, you know, when I was doing all this, fat was the enemy. Like, you couldn't have eat anything. Snack Wells was really big.
It was a different time.
Yeah, a different time. Now it's carbs, but like you couldn't have any fat, which is totally ridiculous at that time. But that was the trend. But I thought everybody should be doing that. And, you know, we ran this clinic, and each one of us had topics. Each one of us had a client at the time that was supervised by the professor, which was a dietitian. And I worked with this client, and it was just eye-opening of the stress and the stress of weight, right? You know, and just the teasing and how stressful it was to maintain a weight. For me, at the time, I was trying to be as heavy as I could, you know, to be as lean as I could and be as heavy as I could. But for somebody going through everything that they had to do and, you know, physiologically, which we'll probably get into later, but physiologically, you know, people are just different. And to say, okay, this is exactly what you should be doing, which is on paper in a book what everybody should be doing, just didn't work for this student.
The cookie cutter approach was not happening.
Was not happening. And just how, I wouldn't say traumatizing, but just how hard a student worked to try to maintain weight and to be healthy, and it just wasn't working. And so that's kind of where, you know, even though I was in sports, they're really like, oh gosh, like everybody can't do what I'm doing or all my friends are doing in the gym. They just can't. They just don't have time. They don't have the capacity. And they don't have the drive either. And then I don't think they have to have that drive, but that was one of the big eye openings. And I think once I took that, once I went into working with the Department of Health and really got interested in obesity and work with individuals. But I think here, for me, one of the big things we're trying to do is actually develop one of my sabbaticals last fall was based on this of trying to have a community weight loss clinic, or not just a weight loss clinic, but a nutrition services clinic that's
led
by some of our grad students. And so we're working on that right now, and we're working with some partnerships to actually, so it's community based, because there's a lot of people that, one is that it's difficult to get these services, just like, you know, maybe not as difficult as mental health services, but it's definitely difficult. You know, it could be like a 2 or 3 month wait at a hospital. And again, you know, depending on your insurance, again, a lot of nutrition services are covered by the insurance, but not all of them. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, what happens if you don't have great insurance, or if you don't qualify for going to, like the Blue Ridge Free Clinic, you know, where we need to meet this
in the middle.
Population in the middle.
Right.
And so it's one of the things that we've been working on, and, you know, hopefully that's going to, you know, span some research, some student involvement. But when dealing with this, we got some students involved, and for me is that just like I had that light bulb moment for my academics in undergrad, seeing the students have that light bulb moment, right? That, you know, a lot of these individuals that you're working with as your clients, they just don't have the same,
you know, concerns or
I mean, they have different needs, you know. They're worried about, especially looking at, you know, socioeconomic status, they could be worried about their, you know, they're not really worried about, are you getting enough fiber? They're worried about, can I actually feed my kids? Not, you know, they're not really worried about the nourishment part of it. I mean, they're worried about it, but they're worried about their lights going off. And so that's just one aspect of it. Or, you know, what happens when you tell an individual, or you're helping an individual cut, you know, like 250 calories. Okay. It could work for the student, but it may not work for the other individual. There may be other things to do. And so to get them to have that light bulb moment where they are like, oh, it's not a textbook answer. We really have to dive in and understand this person and individualize their care. And when students realize that, they're like, oh, you know, and they also understand, oh, wow, I know a lot more than what I thought I knew. And to get them out of their comfort level and to get them into, you know, doing these higher level skills, I think is, I think for me is a really cool.
I'm really excited about that. So this community, hopefully this all works out. This would be available to the community at large here in Harrisonburg and Rockingham.
Yeah.
Okay.
And we're working with RMH on a few things, and hopefully I mean, we're working forward. We've been working on it since last year, and it'll be a sliding scale.
I like that. Services, so. I think that's so important, just in general. But wish we had sliding scales for everything.
Yeah, but even sliding scale, the upper limit would not be. It would be, you know, like a third of what you would pay a private.
Okay. Because we're helping young people and grow in the profession.
Yeah.
So. Oh, I like that.
So maybe next year, by the time we'll do this again, I can advertise that. So.
Yeah, and then we can maybe have some of the students on. Yeah, that would be amazing. Let's do that.
They know a lot more about podcasts than I do, so, you know.
Okay.
Students would be good with that.
So. All right, so that's the goal, right?
The goal.
So a year from now, because I like doing a podcast series on health and fitness for January each year, so that'll be our goal.
Yeah, good.
All right.
Sounds good.
Laughers, you stay tuned and follow us and see this come to fruition next year. I'm excited. I know that we need to talk about this. There is a direct correlation between how we take care of ourselves nutritionally and chronic disease. I would love if you would just give us some broad education about that correlation.
Yeah, you know, this is a very loaded question.
It is. Yes.
So, you know, we have lots of data that suggests that there is a correlation as an individual's weight goes up. And again, we use metrics that a lot of us in the healthcare field do not like BMI, mm-hmm. but it's the easiest to be able to use. And so as that BMI number goes up, that your the incidence of many chronic diseases like obesity, diabetes, hypertension, all the cardiovascular disease, even cancer, that increases as well. So kind of my answer to this is that we have to kind of really look at obesity as a disease. Mm-hmm. And it's not as easy just to look at a person and call them obese. Mm-hmm. They're using this arbitrary number that was done in like late 1800s, mm-hmm. of classifying someone or putting someone in a classification or putting someone in a box. And mm-hmm. us as healthcare professionals, we really don't like doing that. But that's what kind of drives insurance and drives all these ICD numbers and all that. But so for me, when you look at
ICD,
obesity,
hold on, what's
all
ICD?
the insurance numbers?
Okay,
like
the codes,
the codes.
Yes, please. I was just keeping everybody on the same page.
keep me on page. So I think when you look at obesity in general, with individuals dealing with obesity, I think we have to look holistically. We have to look at that individual. Everybody physiologically, we're all different, right? We're all mm-hmm. we're all made totally different, and that's what makes us all wonderful, right? Is the weight? Obviously with obesity, there's an excess of a fat storage, whether it's visceral or like around your organs or the things the fat that you see. Mm-hmm. But you need to look at it as a disease. Does this excess fat lead to a disease, right? Mm. There's a lot of individuals that are walking around that their body is fine mm-hmm. with the excess weight. And there's even really good data to suggest if you're in that, overweight to, beginning obesity, mm-hmm. that you actually have better health outcomes, especially if you get sick. Or if you have cancer, your prognosis with cancer gets better as well. Hmm. But then we can't forget about the data that suggests as that BMI goes up, the actual risk goes up as well. So it's really difficult. And if you kind of look at obesity, it talks about a lot, but there's just so much we do not know about it. So I like to look at it as, is your weight affecting you? And it does affect you.
Mobility,
orthopedic. Mm. We're looking at the psychological aspect of it mm-hmm. as well, because there's so much stigma around it, and so much bias, which even if you look at the data, even within healthcare professionals, nurses and dietitians and exercise physiologists and all of us we have a bias and we have a stigma toward it. And, again, social media is a big influence now.
Yes, it is.
Definitely wouldn't want to be a high schooler now with the social media. I think that
is challenging.
It'd be very challenging.
Yeah.
I think we just need to really look at it as a disease. And when we think about, do we stigmatize somebody that has type 2 diabetes? Right. Mm-hmm. Type 2 diabetes is a disease. It is a medical disease. But do you go around saying, oh, that person's got diabetes, they stay away from them. Or they can't, they're drinking a soda, you need to knock it out of their hand, right? Mm-hmm. We don't go around stigmatizing that. So if we need to look at obesity as a disease. And just like diabetes or cardiovascular disease, there's a lot of genetic components. Yes, behavior is a prime component of this. A really good quote that we can use for a lot of different things, you can use for a lot of it, is, genetics loads the gun and environment pulls the trigger, right?
And oh, interesting. I like that.
And we use that quote for a lot of different things. And I think that's a part of it, because I'm not even going to say 50-50, but both of them are consideration. But if someone that is dealing with obesity, if they feel that they're going to be stigmatized, mm-hmm. right? If they're not going to get the care that is needed, they're not going to go get that environmental piece, right? They're mm-hmm. not going to get that behavioral piece. And so we need to look at it as a disease, just like we do any other disease. The stigma with all these other diseases are just, I'm not saying they're absent, but they're just not as great as we would with an individual dealing with obesity. So
I see that. Yeah. Yeah. The BMI is the body mass index. And how is that measured?
It is measured with weight over height squared.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it's just you look at your weight and height and that's it. It doesn't look at...
Very individualized at all. No.
Like pretty much everybody on NFL's obese, right?
Yeah. Even the quarterbacks. My son, the offensive lineman.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So it doesn't look at the actual body fatness, right? It's kind of an estimation of body fatness. However, it is an easy measure that, you know, anybody can do, but it's also... it's a category, right? We're putting individuals in a category, not really knowing their actual body fatness, right? But exactly. We also can't go around and do other measures that are a lot more expensive. So
that's true. There is cost in the different ways that we measure our body.
That's definitely.
And body fat. The body fat that would be more concerning would be around our heart and lung organs and.
Yeah. And
in the body cavity.
Yeah. So it's called visceral fat. Mm-hmm. So the visceral fat is because everybody has around all of our organs, we have fat. Fat's not mm-hmm. bad. It's not the enemy. It's not the devil.
It has a job.
It has a job. Has lots of jobs. Probably has more jobs than carbohydrates have.
True, actually. Yeah.
So it has. And one of the things is protection. It's thermal regulation for our internal organs, but also protection. It protects us. And again, among many other things, but. And that's one of the things that BMI doesn't catch. You know, the more visceral fat that we have, the higher correlation with chronic disease. But mm-hmm. we're not running around doing scans on everybody to actually look at visceral fat. Even some of the equipment that we have in our labs here really has a hard time. We can there are ways to look at visceral fat, but it has mm-hmm. a hard time looking at visceral fat. And so there are individuals, you know, running around that has an appropriate BMI, right? Mm-hmm. They're inappropriate BMI. However, if you look at the definition of obesity, they are obese because it's mm-hmm. they have excess body fat that is actually leading to a disease. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's why, you know, a lot of us just, you know, BMI is kind of a, I don't know.
It's a little bit outdated.
Outdated, but we still use it. Yeah. We still use it. You know, we still teach it too. Unfortunately, we still teach it, but we do really get our students to, in all the programs that we work with here at Jamie, we really get them to really understand, try to understand the actual client, right? Mm-hmm. You know, try mm-hmm. to get to know them and really understand what's going on and look at every single piece of data, not just one piece of data.
Yeah, that's important, I think. So how do people measure visceral fat these days? How is that done?
The best is looking at a CT scan. So we did one of the studies at Tech that I was a part of. We did CT scans. So we were looking at the different types of fats, and again, it cuts a small section and you can do them in like any different plane that you want. The scans that we have really have a difficult time of actually getting that detailed. Mm-hmm. You're not going to go into a hospital and say, hey, I want a CT scan to see how much visceral fat I have. Yeah, it's just not something.
It's not going to happen that way.
It's not going to happen. And you probably don't want to pay the bill either. Your insurance is probably not going to pay for that.
What they call elective.
Yeah.
Right? Elective. Now, you also studied behavior or even teach behavioral management, right? In terms mm-hmm. of weight management, excuse me. So what are some, based on your experience and expertise, what are some practical pieces of advice for someone to manage their weight that works? What behaviors would...
Yeah, I don't know if this is a practical piece, but I think one of the biggest things, whether we're teaching our students or having clients in the lab, is not weight being the focus.
Not having your weight be the focus.
Yeah, kind of more of a weight neutral type of approach is what we call it. Of like where weight's not, we're trying to be healthy, right? Mm-hmm. And again, we focus in our lab. We're not focused on getting individuals ripped up for the beach. That's not our focus. Our focus is helping individuals be healthy. And mm-hmm. if it means that, you know, we're helping them try to lose 3%, you know, 5%, whatever. Mm-hmm. That's a goal, right? But we really look at, okay, weight shouldn't be the main. And again, you know, it's a little different when we're looking at research versus actually working with individuals as a client. But yeah, just get stop the focus, because it's so stressful, right? Mm-hmm. That number, especially going back, like, this calculation says I should be, you know, should be 155 pounds, mm-hmm. right? How old is that calculation? And what all is put in that calculation with stuff we don't know? So this weight neutral approach is, so not a weight centered or weight neutral, where it's just not the focus. We're looking at lab values. We're looking at, are you instituting healthy behaviors? And so if you're looking at, you know, your five top tips, these can kind of all play into this. But I think it really helps the clients relax a little bit. So they're not really, they're not so focused on
hitting
number.
A certain number on the scale.
Yeah, because I mean, honestly, if you wanted to come in and lose 15 pounds, I could probably do it in 2 days, right? Mm. Is it going to be healthy? No, right? Mm. I'll probably have to borrow your husband's, some of your husband's equipment over there.
Yep, exercise biz lab.
Yeah, you know, get them, you know, wearing trash bags and in a really hot environment, hot humidity environment, and just lose all your water. Mm-hmm. But is that healthy? It's absolutely not healthy. And is it going to help them long term?
Right.
It's not. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, one is just really getting them to really stop focusing on that number. And it's really, really difficult. It's really difficult because everything is really focused on that number. So it's really important to kind of going into that, you know, that weight neutral approach and really just focusing on health. What can we do to get them healthier, right? Because that's our ultimate goal, to get them healthier. Another really good tip that we really teach our students and we run in our clinic is focusing on small goals. And a lot of times we look at, I come in, I'm 280 pounds. My, you know, healthy body weight should be 165. Mm-hmm. Okay. The likelihood of an individual, especially as we age, of going from, you know, 280 to 180 is very difficult. It's very difficult. And the sustainability of that is really difficult. Now, you could probably achieve it, but to be able to stay at that level is going to be very difficult. So we focus on smaller goals. So yes, individuals come in and we ask them their goals. We want them to actually develop their own goals instead of me saying, oh, I want your blood glucose to be this. I want your cholesterol. So we talk to them about, you know, these are the numbers. What do you want to focus on?
Right.
We're not focusing on 15 things, because, you know, you can't do 15 things 100%. So let's focus on one thing. Let's do it 100%. And the more they work on it, we feel, and research shows, if they work on it, that behavior is going to be sustainable.
Becomes a new habit.
It becomes a new habit. It takes a while to become a new habit. Mm-hmm. So focus on those small goals, and really the goals shouldn't be like, oh, I need to get, I'm only supposed to get, in a book, it would say, well, you know, this individual, they have, high cholesterol levels. Mm-hmm. So they need to get 7% of saturated fat. What does that mean? If I told an individual that's their goal, what would that mean to them? They'd be like,
what am I buying at Martin's now?
A lot of our clients would be like, what's a fat? What's a saturated fat? So
that's true.
We try to make everything, like, if it's a nutrition goal, food centered. So, you know, whether it's buying techniques or limiting or reducing the amount of, saturated fat, we teach them all that. So the small goals are really important. I think that's really important. But we also, because we would love for them to stay with us forever, but we know that's not going to happen. So how can we educate them to make their own goals? And so, you know, educating them to where they can make their own goals, these small goals, are really important. And it's also really important if they ever reach maintenance. And we hope that they reach a maintenance phase. And that's one of the things I'm really passionate about, is actually, you know, getting them to change these goals and hopefully making them a habit. But how are they going to sustain that? Because if you look at the data, majority of people that lose weight do not, you know, they don't keep it off. And mm-hmm. because it's really hard. There's a lot of physiological mechanisms that our body wants to remain. It wants to keep onto that fat, right? It doesn't want to get rid of it. And again, with a lot of individuals, maintenance is not a very sexy term, right? Nobody wants to maintain.
It doesn't even sound sexy.
Yeah, right?
Maintenance.
Is there any way we could say that to make it a little sexier? Maybe you can, you know, change the recording in there to make it sound a little more sexy. But it's not a sexy term, and nobody wants to maintain. So what a way, again, we all need to change. You know, whether you're at the weight that you want to be, the way you want to look, the way you want to feel, there's so many things that we can always change. And just to keep it, I guess, you know, if we're trying to spice it up, you know, keep it spicy, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, the small goals are really, I think, is really important. It helps out with the maintenance. Focusing on health instead of like the weight is really important. Another one, it's a really hard one of the big things right now is mindfulness.
I agree.
That's just a big term that gets thrown out, and I don't know if all the definitions are kind of correct. Again, I don't think there's a straight definition for it, but really, and it kind of goes with, you know, there's a whole session of intuitive eating, which are, you know, 10 different steps for intuitive eating. Mindfulness is one of those important aspect, but it's not something that you can just read a book for the average individual and be like, oh yeah, I'm mindful. You need to, there's a lot of things with mindfulness. You need to kind of understand your cues, and it's difficult in today's society of how fast we're always moving. We're going from one place to the next, especially if you're working with individuals that have children. You're going from one sport to the next, or going from, you know, guitar practice, violin practice, you're going to school. I mean, there's so many things that bide our time. It's really hard to kind of slow down and think about what you're consuming. Mm-hmm. And so that's where the mindfulness comes in, like understanding your cues is one of them. So understanding when you're hungry, when you're full, and not trying to overstuff yourself. You're slowing down. And I think it helps you enjoy your food a little bit more as well. But so if you're, you know, again, the average is it takes about 20 minutes from your stomach to tell your brain that you're full. It takes about 20 minutes. And so if you're consuming a lot and you're eating really fast, sometimes you get that, you know, that feeling, especially over the holidays, like, oh my gosh, I just ate way too much. That was way too much. Usually that's, you probably ate a little too fast. So being mindful of your time, being mindful of what you're consuming, especially if you know a little bit more about what you should be consuming, and really trying to be mindful of your cues. Like, are you really hungry or are you bored?
Or are you just eating because it's noon and you think you should have lunch?
Right? Did you wake up and everybody tells you you should eat breakfast? I do think breakfast is really important, but I don't think you should like force yourself to eat because somebody told you to eat. Same thing, like, okay, like you said, it's 12 o'clock. It's the average time to eat.
Right. But am I really hungry?
So understanding those cues, so really understanding those cues, I think is important for mindfulness. Another one I think is really important is really getting into this nourishment versus feeding yourself.
Tell me more about that.
So when you feed yourself, you can feed yourself with anything. You're feeding yourself to physiologically feel satiated. That's what feeding yourself is all about. Now, nourishment is being mindful and, you know, kind of coining terms, intuitive of what you're actually putting in your body. And again, it's easier said than done. But you know, are the foods that you're putting in your body, are they meant to feed you or nourish you? Do they have a really good profile, nutrient profile to actually do the physiological functions that you need
I them to see. Do. How nutrient dense is exactly. this yeah, so, food item? Yeah. Is it an Oreo or an apple?
Exactly. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
So both of them are vegan, like, at least, right?
got that.
So, you know, I think it's really important, and that kind of goes with the mindfulness of like, you know, what are your intentions for eating? And I'm all about, you know, consuming things that are enjoyable. I think we really should enjoy food. And that would probably be my last thing is like, you know, try not to stress about it too much because stressed leads to overeating. And again, you know, we're not getting super physiological here, but you know, there are mechanisms, brain and GI, is that when you get stressed, your tendency are going to go to things that are highly palatable, or like a lot of sugar, a lot of fat. And I always tell my students, especially during exam time, if you think about the word stressed, it is desserts spelled backwards. So there's a you know, word correlation there as well. But I think, you know, just don't get so stressed out about it. Because I think the more you stress out about it, stress out about your weight, I think the worst things you are, because we know that stress can lead to chronic disease as well.
Also increasing your cortisol.
Increasing cortisol.
Which cortisol is not necessarily a bad thing, but...
Acutely, like...
Exactly.
Acutely, cortisol is not a bad thing, but chronically, cortisol leads to extra fat storage that we know of. And there's a lot we don't know about cortisol. So cortisol is not a bad thing, not a bad guy, but we need to find ways, be mindful, other things. We can talk about meditation, all these other things to try to, you know, chronically reduce that cortisol. But again, none of us are ever stressed, right? We're never stressed. Why should we stress?
What's there to be stressed about?
So I think, you know, I don't know if that's five things, but I think, you know, these are some of the big things that we teach and really try to run through the lab when we work with clients. And again, there's a lot of different things because it's very individualized of what individuals want to work on. And that's usually our first session is really looking at, all right, you know, again, building, you're building that rapport, but you know, what are you here for? What do you want to get out of this? You know, how can we help? And then how can we teach you to help yourself and how to educate yourself? So
how long is the average time you would say you work with somebody as a client? Is there an average time or it varies a lot or how does that?
Yeah, I think it depends on the need. I mean, the things that we've done right now are usually based on like research or based on, you know, kind of free sessions. So we haven't really looked at that. And usually there's a little bit more standard to it because it's based on research. I would say initial is usually about an hour. I wouldn't want to go over an hour. And then it'd all be based on what your needs are. I think 30 minutes to an hour, especially to begin with. Now, we do get into some situations where definitely there's more, I think there's more behavioral and psychological things that we need to get into that may be out of our scope of practice that we need to bring someone else in.
A referral, yeah.
Which we have had had to do that before just because I think there was... this needed to be addressed before we can address the nutrition piece. And, and that's happened a few times. And again, it's out of my scope, definitely out of my student scope as well. But we do have individuals we can refer to as well. But yeah, you know, I think it all depends. It's very individualized. I think some sessions, I think, you know, the first few sessions, an hour, I think if you need a little bit more, some people we work with that they really like that accountability. And they like coming in every week and or every 2 weeks and talking through things. So some's like, oh yeah, just I need this, I need a little push, and let me talk to you in like 3 or 4 weeks.
So, okay,
you know, I think it all depends. You know, and we don't have great research to, you know, the research is all over the place of like how many times, especially as you get into the maintenance piece, there's no research to show like, well, you need to come every 6 months or you come every year. Which, you know, I think it's just when you're feeling a little overwhelmed and you need somebody to talk to and you need some, you know, some of that accountability, I think is really important. But
how do you measure these behavioral weight management
goals? We measure them by the goals.
Okay.
So if the goals is, let's just say an individual's working with, they come in and we want to lower cholesterol levels. Say their low density lipoprotein cholesterol levels are high. And then we work with that client that's saying, okay, you know, again, we're talking to them. What can they do? Let's just say one of the things is, you know, increase in fiber. We know that we have good data that supports if you increase fiber, these are things that is going to help with cholesterol levels. So a goal would be, I want to, you know, I'm going from zero vegetables per day. I want to incorporate, you know, I want to incorporate a half a cup of carrots. I want to incorporate 1 cup of salad mix, preferably in like more of the kale, the dark leafy kale, spinach. per day or every 2 days, right? Mm-hmm. And so you just be very specific, and we call them SMART goals: specific, measurable, attainable, realistic, and timely. And that's what we teach our students, that you can actually measure that. So we can look, we can ask them next week, how many days did you meet this goal? Did you meet this goal? Okay. And one of the things that we do is we actually give them, we write them a nutrition prescription.
Oh, that's good.
That has that goal on it. Mm-hmm. Whether they want to post it in the car or post it on the refrigerator, you know, whatever the goal is, we give them that prescription card where they actually can look at that, and they have that nutrition prescription. Just like a physician, when you come in, if you write a prescription for medication, mm-hmm. they'd be like, are you taking medications? Like, all right, are you increasing your fiber by doing these, you know, eating some carrots and some spinach? So
now let's say a lot of our laughers are different age ranges in different parts of the country and different parts of the world too. So let's just talk about people that aren't students at JMU and they were looking for a nutrition prescription. Where in the community would they be able to find, or online even, where they might be able to find some resources to get a nutrition prescription?
So the best place would be eatright.org.
Okay.
If you go on eatright.org, you can go onto one of the radio buttons and it says find a professional. And you type in your zip code, and it'll tell you all the outpatient professionals around that area. You can also, especially if you're dealing with a chronic disease, you can talk to your primary care physician, and they can schedule something with the outpatients at the hospital as well. And again, not every individual consultant would take insurance. So that's one of the things that you have to consider. And some of them, that's one of the reasons why we're wanting to do this community program, because some of them could be, $150, $200 an hour. Mm-hmm. Right? Some of them have packages, and some of them focus on certain things. So that's one of the things that you have to consider as well. If you can work with your PCP and get it through an outpatient counseling, that would help out with the insurance. But, so it's Eat Right, eatright.org. And you look at find a professional. I think it's find a professional or find an expert. And you type in your zip code, and it'll list all the ones that are taking individuals. So
PCP, primary care physician, is what we mean by that.
Yeah.
This is why I love talking to people, laughers. I had no idea that website existed, and I want to go check it out. Yeah. Eatright.org.
Yeah, and it has material for. Obviously it has a professional side because it's our professional organization, but it has materials if you're not a member. Quick link website tips and tricks and those types of things that what you're looking for. So
I love it. Speaking of eating right, is there any nutritional myths out there that just drive you crazy, that get spread all around and make you go,
lots of them.
Okay.
Lots of them. I think the biggest one is that... that not all foods fit. And I don't think that's appropriate. I think there is a place for every food. The big thing now is like carbs, right?
Mm-hmm.
Carbs cause all sorts of disease. And again, there are actually a lot of, physicians that are, they're actually anti-carb, especially a lot of cardiovascular physicians, that are kind of more of like, the keto, the Atkins diet, where it's a very low carbohydrate diet and, higher fat, like around 70% fat and only probably around, about 7 to 10% carbohydrate and the rest filled in with protein. And that's just one example. I think there's a lot of things out there where, I can't have this or I can't have that. Because it leads to disease, and really it doesn't. It's usually, it's going to be that overindulgence of certain things.
Mm.
I think everything fits. I'll give you an example. In grad school, when I was going through my internship, I was working with this individual when I was at the end of my rotation. So I was able to do staff release, and this person comes in. And I was helping them with, with weight, and I was helping them with the cholesterol. And the first thing they said to me is like, slammed their hand down and said, "I'm going to eat my fried chicken." I was like,
Okay.
I was like, okay. I was like, let's work around that. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, so if I had told that person like fried chicken does not fit in your diet, they're going to give me lip service and they're going to go out and eat fried chicken. Right.
And not so, do other things. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And so how can I individualize that person's, and this is what we teach our students. How can you individualize that person to fit fried chicken? Now I don't advise eating fried chicken every single day, mm-hmm. but if you can incorporate it and if you build that rapport with them, like, yeah, let's just fit this in. Like, and so they feel like they're, that you're listening to them and you're making, and you feel, make them feel special, but you know, mm-hmm. it's not a sheet that I pulled out and just handed it to you, that I'm writing something individualized for you. So I do feel like everything fits. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, you need to, you know, kind of balance that indulgence versus moderation, right? Mm-hmm. If you like fried chicken, eat fried chicken. If you, especially around this area at this time, if you like a cookie, you know, eat a cookie, just don't eat the whole, you know, dozen, right?
Exactly.
I mean, I think it's like with anything, right? It's like drinking or, you know, eating.
Moderation is key.
It's moderation is key. So everything fits. And to say that, no, I have to take fat out, or I have to take, you know, I have to take, you know, carbohydrates out, or, you know, I got to eat this certain thing that's going to cleanse me. And, you know, it's not really anything that's going to cleanse you. Mm-hmm. So it's just, I think there's a lot of things out there, especially with influencers, of saying, you know, I did this and it did this for me.
It can work for you. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just a blanket.
And it might not work as well.
Yeah. Or it might be damaging, right? Mm-hmm. There's been a lot of cases, especially nutritionally, that people are doing things that are actually very harmful, that have called liver disease and actually called people to die. So, I mean, it's the same thing with like water, right? Water needs moderation. Yes, water is great. We need water. We're 65% water, but there is a point where you can drink too much water, right? So it's the same thing with moderation.
You can drink too much water.
Yeah.
What happens when we drink too much water?
It actually fills up your cells and can cause your cells to die. If you have, it's called hyponatremia. And it actually messes with your electrolyte imbalances.
Okay.
So you have to, you can drink too much water. You can drink too much
people
water.
People have actually...
They actually died from drinking way too much water, so...
I did not know that.
Yeah. Look up if you get... There's a radio host that somebody... I don't know how long ago, but it was called Hold Your Wee for a Wee, mm-hmm. when Wee was out.
Like, oh, yeah, 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 yeah.
And you had to drink so much water and you had to hold it for so long, and it actually a person died from it. So, but yeah, you can't just like with anything. So I think everything fits. And,
even water can be too much.
Yeah, but water's good. You got to drink your water, but
it's just,
I think some of those things where, you know, that's the thing that really gets me, is that, you know, there's a superfood, or you need to get rid of this because it's doing you harm. And that's just not the way. You know, it's just not the way. Our bodies are resilient, and there's things that we need. And by eliminating them, it just confuses your body. So
it can cause more trouble than it's worth. Yeah. It sounds like.
And stress. It causes stress.
Yeah. And we want to keep that down. Yeah. Now cleansing. Did I catch that you're not a big fan of cleansing?
I'm not a fan of cleansing.
That's what I thought I heard. Tell me why.
Just by getting rid, because it doesn't get to the root of the problem. Like, why do you need to cleanse? You know, just drinking water for like, or you know, vinegar for drinking vinegar is not a great thing anyway with a pH balance. But, you know, if I'm just going to have some honey and lemon and water, and I'm going to go do that for like 5 or 6 days, you may get rid of some toxins in your body. I mean, mm-hmm. you're really going to do more harm to your microbiome, so the good bacteria within your digestive tract, then mm-hmm. you would actually get with like the cleanse. And but it doesn't get to the, you know, we want to make behavior changes.
Yeah.
And so why do you think you need a cleanse? What are you doing that you think you need a cleanse? Mm. So we need to address that before, because what's going to happen after you think that you cleanse, that you're going to come back and do
and the same haven't
thing.
Changed any of your bad habits, exactly. then it's still going to come back.
Yeah. So I'm not a,
I see.
And there's just no data. I'm evidence-based. I need to have data to support that a nutritional cleanse actually is helpful. And from the data that I have seen. I'm going to say that's not out there, but the data I've seen, it just doesn't, it's just limited and doesn't, it, what I've seen is that actually does more harm, especially when you're looking at your gut microbiome, which is super, super important that we're learning a lot more about.
So. Yeah. I wanted to ask about that. I'm glad you mentioned gut biome again, because I had a question, then it left, now it's back. So we want, let's say our gut biome, which is hugely important to our overall health, mm-hmm. and nutritional health. Let's say it's in a bad spot. It's not healthy. What kind of time frame does it take once you start making behavioral changes and nutritional changes to take what would be an unhealthy gut biome to a healthy one? Is it weeks? Is it months?
Yeah, I think that's going to be all individual. It depends on how, you know, how bad is it. And when we think about the biome, we think about the diversity of it. And I think that's one of the things that we're learning a lot more about. It's not just, you know, eating three different strands from yogurt, right?
Right.
It's everything. Like, you, we need that diversity of it. And it's great. You know, some of the research that NIH has done with the Microbiome Project is they actually are looking at the genetics of each one of the organisms.
Okay.
So with the genetics and looking at the strand sequencing, they can actually kind of determine how they interact with the other microorganisms and how, not just individually, but how as a, almost like a colony, how they come together to actually affect our GI health. And,
wow.
and like you said, Dawn, you're correct, is that, you know, a healthy microbiome actually, we were finding how that actually leads to, like if it's a poor, diverse microbiome, can actually lead to some of the chronic diseases that we're talking about. So there's connections with looking at the diversity and also some of the decrease in risk factors. And so, you know, ways to help out with that is not only having like your probiotics, you know, which is going to be like your yogurts, some of your fermented things, but then also looking at your prebiotics as well. So looking like what a prebiotic is, what that microorganism is going to eat. And so that's where you get into the fiber. And so you go back to eliminating, when you're eliminating food, especially when you eliminate things like carbohydrates, your microbiome doesn't actually have anything to eat. Right. So some of the, you know, soluble and insoluble fibers can actually help feed that and increase that diversity. So as far as how long it takes, you know, I think it's going to be individual.
I
don't know. I don't want to put a, you know.
Like a too big time frame out there. It's definitely not going to happen overnight. Nah, we know that.
Not going to happen overnight. And the poor diversity didn't happen overnight as well.
That's true. So yeah.
I don't want to put a time on it because I don't really know.
It's going to vary, laughers. Yeah, that's what. Yeah. The
variety,
point.
Right? We talk about variety.
Yeah, spicing it up. Before we get out of here, though, I want to ask you, we talked about the behavioral, you know, modifications that we can make with the small goals and that those type of things. I want to talk more specifically about nutrition, what we eat. So there's three different groups I want to talk about, just general nutrition and weight management. What would be your top five tips to be improving your nutrition? What should we be doing?
Okay.
In terms of what we're eating.
I think one is looking at the amount of processed food we have. Again, it's
that's a good one.
I wouldn't say it's my top tip, but it's one of the ones that we looked at, and it's difficult. Trust me, I understand. I have kids. I understand how difficult it is. But I think if we can try to reduce the amount that we have, and I'm not saying get rid of it. There's some people out there that would say we can't have any processed food. It's not our body's meant to. But I think if we can just kind of reduce that, if you reduce your processed food, you're going to reduce a lot of the things that are high sugar and
naturally,
high sugar and high fat. So
right.
I think you're naturally going to do that. So that's going to be one. Another one, I would say this is probably one of my top ones, is definitely, it goes with chronic disease and weight, is increasing your fruits and vegetable consumption.
I could do a better job of that. I actually like fruits and vegetables, but I still can do a much better job with that.
Yeah, it's difficult because, you know, first one, they're expensive. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, if, They go bad. You know, they definitely have a shelf life, but if we can increase that, and there's also like a lot of scares, right? You had the things out there that are called the Dirty Dozen. They come out every year of like which ones have the most, you know, pesticides and all that kind of stuff on it. Just wash them, right? Mm-hmm. You know, just wash them. The fruits and vegetables are going to do a lot more good than they would do harm.
Right? Yes.
Unless they've been tainted by, but if you're washing your stuff, you should be fine. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So increasing fruits and vegetables, if you could get, you know, whatever, I mean, recommendations is like, you know, upwards to like 9, like combined fruits and vegetables per day. If you can get, you know, two fruits, and we're not talking fruit juice. We're not talking about the actual.
I'm glad you clarified that.
Not talking about fruit. Even it's a
real apple.
Yeah. Or the tomato sauce on pizza.
That doesn't count.
No, something that's, you know, crunchy, something that's going to get your GI tract going, that has that fiber content. If you can, you know, if you can get like 2 fruits per day and about 3 servings of vegetables, that would be a great start. Mm-hmm. And thinking of ways, there are a lot of creative, like go on all the social media. There are a lot of things that you could do for, to be creative with it, especially if you're working with kids. And trust me, I understand how difficult it is to get kids to consume these things, but you know, just there's a lot of creative things that are out there to get people to consume them. So you don't have to eat this massive bowl of salad every single day, but you know, increasing that. Another one's water consumption.
Yeah,
that's another one. Again, not, you know, not drinking like 4 gallons a day, but you know, if you're getting the old standard is 8 ounces 8 times a day, so 64 fluid ounces. You know, we have no clue where that number came from.
But it's a standard today.
Yeah, it's a standard, and it's easy to remember. Now that all changes with humidity, I think your good rule of thumb, you know, 8 fluid ounces 8 times a day would be great. Some other ones, you know, I think a big one is just don't stress about it. Right?
Yeah, that's coming back up. It's thematic
just,
today.
But it's so hard because like we get individuals come in and just get so stressed about it. It's like, you know, because there's so many rules and regulations, and then we're getting like, well, this one had listeria, you know, this one had, it's just, you know, just don't try not to stress about it. It's food, enjoy it, but also think about how it nourishes. So, you know, just don't get stressed about it so much. Lastly, what's another thing? I think one of the big ones that you hear all the time is just like we've talked about is, you know, balance that indulgence with moderation. You know, have a cookie, eat a cookie, don't eat a dozen of them, right? You know, if you want a donut, eat a donut, don't eat a dozen donuts. Even if that hot sign is on, don't eat a dozen of them. Try not to say
the hot sign is tempting.
Try not to say the name. Try not to say the name because I don't know if you're, you know, affiliated with them yet, or you're trying to get some sponsors here.
Not yet, but Krispy Kreme, you can talk to me if you would like.
Here you go. So I think, you know, just a balance on it. Everything fits. A lot of things that we've already talked about. As far as athletes, you know, are we talking about a weekend warrior athlete, or are we talking about athletes that are actually trying to compete? And I think that's a, you know, a big discussion when we talk about athletes. I really advise if you are an athlete that you are trying to compete at a competitive level, I would suggest reaching out to a dietitian if you really want to improve your
really
nutrition.
Really fine tune.
Because a lot of things we talked about today is I wouldn't say vague, but it's really for
the general population.
So we're talking about 80, 85, 90% of the population. If you're, you know, in that 10% of population that you're this elite, you know, or an athlete that's trying to be elite, I would really reach out. There are some tremendous coaches out there. Again, if you can pay for them, there are some tremendous coaches out there that help you out. We actually have many students that are coaches now. But one of the things to look for is, you know, look at their, you know, their pedigree. But also if you're getting nutrition advice, you know, make sure it's a registered dietitian, because we are actually held by a code of ethics. We have a standards that we don't, our code of ethics is not to do super extreme stuff. That's not in our code. We're meant to go evidence-based. And if it's not evidence-based, we're not supposed to prescribe it. You know, I think with an athlete, it's so individual. You got to find what works for you. And I think there's so many, I call them notebook plans, where you just rip it out of a notebook and you hand it to somebody. That doesn't work for an athlete. It doesn't really work for chronic disease population. It doesn't work for an athlete as well. So you got to know, what works. You know, can you, if you're a runner, you know, can you carb load? You know, can you consume goo, which is like just a glucose, during a run? You know, can you do that? Like what can you tolerate? What's going to help you? What's not going to help you? So there's a lot of trial and error with athletes, and that's, you know, that may be a whole
another, that's a whole nother podcast.
Maybe another podcast there talking about athletes, because it's that's a
and
lot
the timing of when you
time
eat
and nutrients.
And there you're burning way more calories than the general population,
I think one of the things, if you could go, just one recommendation for athletes is that consuming something right after a workout, whether it's a strength workout, whether it's a strength workout, or whether it's a whether it's a run or a cycle or a swim or whatever, consuming something after is really important. Water is super important right after, and having something that's got protein and carbohydrates in it. So it's got to have both of it in it to actually get that improvement for muscle synthesis, right? And again, you don't need 100 grams of protein, right? I think 25 grams is a really good amount, and that's where usually most of the research is about. And usually it's about a 2-to-1, 3-to-1 carbohydrate ratio. So 50 to 75 grams of carbohydrates with that protein. And I guess my last thing with an athlete is don't buy into the hype of you've got to have all this protein. And again, it's not going to hurt you. No parents may be out there being, well, you can't have too much protein because it's going to hurt your kidneys and liver. There's hardly any data as to support that. If it's harming your liver and kidneys, you're probably doing something else that you shouldn't be doing. You don't need all those, all those protein shakes. You don't have all these meals with proteins. I think one of the biggest things is if you look, so a good example, so an average individual, so where we talk about, chronic disease, about 0.8 grams per kilogram.
Okay.
Right? That's not per pound, that's per kilogram.
Per kilogram.
Which equals out to about 0.36 grams per pound. If you're going into the athlete, depending on the athlete, if you're like an elite athlete, you can get up around that 2 grams per kilogram, right?
Wow.
2 grams per kilogram.
Okay.
Most individuals, if they're high school athletes or college athletes or,
weekend warriors,
probably around that 1.5 to 1.6. Mm-hmm. But if you look at popular media, they're pushing this, 1 to 2 grams per pound of body weight. And obviously they're usually selling a product, right? Mm-hmm. That's one of the most popular selling fitness product is protein powder, right? Mm-hmm. So, there's a reason for that. It's a marketing reason for that. So your body does not need that. Your body handles protein a little bit differently than carbohydrates and fats. All right. So we always have this, like what we call a metabolic pool of amino acids that we pull from. You're not going to be any muscle wasting if you don't get that 2 grams per pound. You're just going to be wasting a lot of it. You're going to be getting rid of a lot of it. And it's also, turns into, carbohydrates. Right?
So yeah.
The carbon part of a carbon part of amino acids turns into carbohydrates. Yep. We don't really get rid of that. So I think that's just a big one. This is like this fascination with
It's a crazy huge trend right now.
Yeah. Well, it's been a trend ever since I was competing, but I bought into it. I'm a hypocrite because I bought into it. Like when I was that age, I was like, I got to have protein every hour and. But yeah, it's just, I think it's just kind of crazy of
how your opinion of that has changed over time.
Yeah. When Taco Bell comes out and says they have a protein taco, that's, it's just it's a little extreme, but, so
you heard it right here first, Laffers. I appreciate that. What about people with chronic disease? Is there anything that they should be paying attention to?
Yeah, I mean, I think it depends
for
on
what they eat.
I think it depends on the chronic disease. Obviously, if you're dealing with cholesterol, I think looking at your fat intake, looking at your total fat intake, looking at your saturated fat intake, which is going to be animal based products. Again, throwing coconut products out of that, but any animal based product is going to have that saturated fat. So trying to reduce that, and I'm not going to say eliminate it. If you want to. If you want a steak, you want a hamburger, go ahead and do that. But you don't really need to be consuming a 16-ounce T-bone, right?
Yeah.
Unless you split that up into like three or four meals, right? You don't. That's the stuff that you don't. You need to kind of really reduce the amount that you're consuming, and that's going to help out with cholesterol. I think it's hypertension. The two biggest things with hypertension is really looking at your sodium content. And again, there's people out there that says it doesn't correlate, but physiologically it does correlate. But you know, reducing sodium content, and again, it kind of goes with what we talked about: processed foods. Mm-hmm. Trying to reduce some of the processed foods. Trying to reduce the amount that we eat out. Again, I understand we're a society that has to eat out a lot, just because our demands on our life is just it's just crazy. Our demands, but trying to reduce the amount, and I think if you do cook at home, just don't salt it. Right? Taste it before you salt it. Now, again, if you're baking, obviously there's a chemical reaction there, but just trying to reduce the amount of salt. But on the flip side of that is increasing the amount of potassium that you intake. And I'm not talking about potassium pills. I'm talking about fruits and vegetables. That's where you're going to get the majority of your potassium. And so if you're, we're supposed to be getting around 2,300 milligrams of sodium per day, which is, a can of soup, right? Mm-hmm. If you get a can of soup, you're pushing your 2,300 milligrams right there. But if you're getting 2,300 milligrams, you should be getting around 4,600 milligrams of potassium, which would be about the equivalent of an avocado and a half.
Avocado.
Yeah, if you like avocado, that's a great source of potassium. Probably one of the best sources of potassium. Obviously, bananas are as well, but a lot of your fruits and vegetables are going to have that higher potassium content. Those are important aspects for that. And again, I think when we think about cancers, chronic diseases are the three big chronic diseases that we think about. It's really what are you going to do to reduce your risk, right? Mm-hmm. It's not something that I think we can prevent. Personally, I don't think knowing what I know about cancer, we just can't prevent it. We just need to reduce the risk. The same things is the same things are increasing fruits and vegetables, trying to reduce the amount of processed food we intake, increasing your water, trying to reduce stress. Obviously, your husband talks all about physical activity, so I didn't mention a lot of physical activity. Every one of these, I could say physical activity for all these, but it's the same things over and over and over, right? Fruits and vegetables, limiting processed food, trying to reduce stress, whether it's stress from eating, moderation. These are all the things. I don't like to use the word simple because it's not a simple task. I think, eating is not a simple task, even because it's something.
You got to think about it. You got to plan it, take time to do it. Yeah.
But it's something that we have to do every day.
Yes.
It's something we have to eat. If we don't eat, we die. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a stressful piece of it because you have to do it. It's because you have to think about it. And
not really optional.
And sometimes you think about a little too much. Yeah. especially around the holidays, you think about a little too much.
That's when we're recording is right now, right before Christmas, and you'll see us. Yeah. You'll see this in mid-January. So that's exciting. I do want to ask you, what do you think about intermittent fasting? Oh boy.
Yeah.
I saw the head tilt. There's a lot of thoughts there.
It's a lot of thoughts. I mean, intermittent fasting, and again, there's a lot of different, there's a few different variations of intermittent fasting. Some are days fast, like a 2-day fast, 5 days on, 2 days off. There's some that are, 16 hours of a fast, 8 hours of eating. Some are a little bit more extreme, 18 hours of fast, 6 hours of eating. And then there's, spiritual fasting as well, but I'm sure you're not talking about spiritual fasting. The data is not conclusive for me to actually recommend it. If you look at definitely, the data is, I think, a little bit better for athletes, especially if you're in a aesthetic type of competition where you need to reduce, 2% body fat, 3% body fat, or you just need to lose a little bit. I think the data is a little bit better there. It's just not very conclusive for a chronic disease management. Mm-hmm. We actually did a study for a bodybuilding population, or lifting competition, but most of them were bodybuilders, for looking at, it was energy restriction. So not actually intermittent fasting, but energy restriction. So it was intermittent energy restriction, where you go up to your RMR, so your resting metabolic rate of like what you need to consume a day to like maintain. Mm-hmm. And then we cut it by 50% for a few mm-hmm. days. And so we had a few different those. We didn't find anything really conclusive about it. We wanted mm-hmm. to make sure that we weren't messing with a resting metabolic rate. We didn't want to mess with your metabolism, or we didn't want to mess with cortisol or testosterone, those types of things. We really didn't find much out of it. We didn't have a huge sample size, but we didn't find much out of it. You know, I think it's with anything, if it works for you and you do it correctly, where you're still nourishing yourself, I think it's fine, you know, but you want to make sure if you're doing a 16 hours fast, 8 hours eating, you want to make sure that 8 hours you're not over consuming. So if you're on a 2000 calorie diet, well, that's what you needed to maintain your weight, or you're trying to do a reduction or something. You want to make sure during that 8 hours mm-hmm. That you don't overconsume that, right? Because it's still about, you know, again, it's not as simple as calories in, calories out, but you want to make sure that you're not overconsuming. But you also want to make sure that you're nourishing yourself during that time. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it works for some individuals. Some individuals really like the break, mm-hmm. and they like just that I can only eat this time. It also helps out that if you're not eating late at night, like right before bed. Some people like it, some people don't. I have not seen a massive difference, and I haven't seen the evidence behind it that it's one of the things that we say, yes, you need to do this.
In order to lose weight, you have to do this. That's not necessarily true.
But if it works for you, and if it's a good way,
and you like it,
I think it's a good way. If mm-hmm. let's say you overconsume calories, if mm-hmm. that's a behavioral issue that you just have a hard time with this, but if you only have this window of 8 hours mm-hmm. to be able to consume, or 6 hours, whatever, if you only have this window, then if that helps you reduce, you know, 200 to mm-hmm. 500 calories, then it's probably appropriate for you. Mm. But you just can't at that time just overconsume, mm-hmm. right? You just got to make sure that you're nourishing yourself and doing it correctly. But yeah, I mean, it's not something I would be like, oh yes, this person needs to, like, everybody needs to be on intermittent fasting. But I think with anything, I think if it fits in a person's lifestyle and they can still be healthy, and that's, if we're kind of ending, that's kind of the big thing, no matter what population that you're working with, whether it's an athlete, you know, an individual with obesity or individual with chronic disease, is that the nutrition piece, like our goal and our job is to help you be healthy. Mm. And however we can do that, where you're healthy through nutrition, is what we want to do. And that's our main goal. And if it's, you want to do IF, because if I can tell you, like, no, don't do IF.
Intermittent fasting.
I can tell you not to do intermittent mm-hmm. fasting, but if you come in saying you want to do it, I need to make sure that you're going to do it correctly. Same thing with keto, right? I've worked mm-hmm. with individuals that have done a ketogenic diet, which is a low carbohydrate diet. They come in, I'm going to do this. All right, let's make sure that you're doing it healthy and you're being nourished. Mm. And that's the key to all this, is like, let's just be healthy, right? And again, healthy is a term that gets thrown out. A better word would be nourished, making sure that you have the appropriate nutrition to, you know, to make your body function properly.
I think that's a great note to end on. So before we get out of here, though, there are some laughers that would probably love to get in touch with you if they have questions or want to connect. So how best can they do that?
Yeah, I think I have too much too much out there to be on social media. I don't want to ruin my job here. So I don't do social media. But my email address is great. Is Akers, Akers, JD as in Delta, at jmu.edu. I'm also pretty easy to find. I am the only male dietitian on JMU's campus. Going back to our first story. So I'm pretty easy to find as well. So, you know, please reach out if you have any questions or anything. I'd love to chat. Or if you need to get in contact with someone locally, I can help you with those resources as well. So
that's amazing. Thank you so much for coming on today, Dr. Akers. I really enjoyed visiting with you. I learned so much I did not know before. So I appreciate you for that and so much more. It truly was a pleasure today. Thanks again.
Yeah, the pleasure's all mine. I appreciate it, Dawn. Thank you so much.
You are welcome. And laughers, we'll be sure to put that email address for you in the show notes as well. So if you're working out or driving somewhere, do not worry. You can grab that later. And we just want to thank you for being here with us today, listening. If you liked what you heard and enjoyed your time with us today, please give this podcast a like, share, and tell a friend. We truly would appreciate it. We can't do anything that we do without you. And that is the true story right there. So thank you from the bottom of my heart. And lastly, and most importantly, thanks for tuning in, laughers. Out of all the podcasts out there, you picked us, and we think that's pretty darn special, just like you. Until next time, keep smiling. Bye.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Virginia is for Laughers podcast, brought to you by the Funny Womacks and Friends. We'll be dropping a new podcast every Wednesday, so check back for another uplifting episode. Come to a FWAF show or let us bring one to you. To find out more, head to thefunnywomacks.com. Be sure to share this podcast with a friend, and until next time, cheers.